At Grace Church, we love to open the Bible, read it, and spend some time just really thinking about what it says to us, because we believe that the Bible is God's Word. You'll sometimes hear people describe it as God's Word or the Word of God. We believe that when we open the Bible, that is God speaking to us. You might have thought in your life at some point, oh, wouldn't it be great if God just spoke to me directly? Well, when we open the Bible, that is what he's doing. And it's far better than us just coming up with our own ideas of what God might be like, or listening to my ideas or Ben's ideas or whoever's up here. We want to see how God's revealed himself to us, how he truly is. And so it's been great over the last few weeks to be looking through the book of Mark, which is one of the biographies of Jesus. And so it's just telling us different things that Jesus said, different things he did, different people he interacted with. And it allows us to encounter Jesus on like his own terms. And the writer of this book, Mark, that's why it's called that, is really sort of challenging us to think about this question, who is Jesus? Like, he's shown us event after event in Jesus' life, and we've been confronted with the question, like, who is Jesus? What is he actually like? And so in the lead up to this chapter, we've been seeing Jesus perform a lot of miracles. He's done miracle after miracle, and we've seen his power over nature, over like evil spirits, over illness, over death. And because he's doing all these miraculous things, he's getting surrounded by crowds everywhere he goes. And so over the last couple of chapters, it's common to see, oh, Jesus goes here, and then the crowd follows him there, and then he gets in a boat to try and go, and then there's a crowd waiting for him when he gets there. And then the first part of this chapter is a bit of a break from all those miracles, where there's some conflict with the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the sort of religious leaders of the Jewish people. And they have a conflict about sort of cleanliness, not like physical cleanliness, but like spiritual purity. And the Pharisees kept loads and loads of different rules and regulations and traditions and rituals to maintain their spiritual purity or cleanliness. The one that they argue about is about sort of ceremonial hand washing before eating food. And they come into conflict because Jesus says that external stuff is way less important than what's actually going on inside a person. Like, people might look on the external stuff, but God looks at the heart. And that's what the controversy was and this conflict that Jesus has with the religious leaders. And then he goes straight from there and, like, in a physical sort of demonstration of the difference in their beliefs there about what makes somebody right with God, Jesus goes from there into a Gentile region. And that's what we're going to be reading about today. You hear him in the vicinity of a city called Tyre. And then he goes down through Sidon to another city. The Pharisees, the sort of respectable Jewish people, wouldn't be seen dead in these areas. Gentile is just a word that means non-Jews. And Jews and Gentiles didn't mix. They wouldn't have gone to these places. There's examples in sort of other literature of where if they needed a journey and the sort of easiest way was through one of those places, they'd go around, they'd take the long way around to avoid these sort of people. And even if they had to go through those places, they wouldn't be mixing with Gentiles. They wouldn't be interacting with them in the way that Jesus does here. Gentiles were not Jewish people. They weren't keeping all the ceremonial laws. They were unclean. And so if you mixed with them, then you were unclean as well. So you just need to stay away from those sort of people. Now, this particular city of Tyre where Jesus goes to has like a long history of being sort of a problem to the Israelites, to the Jews. There was a king of Israel sort of way back called Ahab who married one of the princesses from Tyre, Jezebel. And that name has become known even today as sort of like a dodgy sort of character because she sort of brought in the worship of other gods and sort of pagan worship and idolatry into the nation of Israel. And Tyre and Sidon, these two cities that we're going to sort of see Jesus passing through today, were notorious for what Jews would have seen as evil behavior and particularly worship of other gods. And so if you read some of the prophets in the Old Testament, they're always saying about Tyre and Sidon and other places, saying they're going to be destroyed because of their bad behavior. And so you can see why the Jews, it wasn't just like random prejudice, you can see why they thought, oh, they're dodgy characters, they've led people astray in the past. We don't want to mix with them. We don't want to go anywhere near that. And so bear that in mind as we just read these stories now to see how Jesus interacts with Gentiles. I'm going to pick it up from verse 24. Jesus left that place and went into the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. There, some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spat and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." At this, the man's ears were opened. His tongue was loosed and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. "He has done everything well," they said. "He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." I don't think this is much of a surprise, is it? Like, how does Jesus interact with these Gentile people? The same way he's interacting with everybody else. He has compassion on them. He cares for them. He notices their individual situations. He loves them. He heals them. It's the same experience as before. We see here Jesus' power is unmatched. Everything he comes up against in these chapters we've been reading over the last few weeks, nothing's a match for his power. Same here. Demon-possessed girl. He's not even there with her, and he just heals her. This man who's deaf and can't speak heals him. Jesus has power over everything he faces, and as he does when he's mingling among the Jews, he uses that unlimited power to bless people. That includes Gentiles. So I want to look at a couple of things that are just sort of things that stood out to me from this text that I think are useful for us, and then really finish with just that question we've been considering all the way through this book, which is, what does this tell us about who Jesus is? The first thing that just really stood out to me, and we'll just touch on this briefly, but it stood out to me, and I think it'll be helpful to some people here, is one thing that is a similarity between this woman who has the demon-possessed daughter and the man who is deaf and unable to speak, is that they both use the word begging. There's both people begging Jesus. So this woman comes and she falls at Jesus' feet, it said in verse 5. And then verse 26, she begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. And verse 32, some people brought this man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. There's here people, just desperate people, begging Jesus. And the interesting thing is, it's not the person themselves. They're both examples of people begging Jesus to help somebody else. They're begging Jesus on somebody else's behalf. We don't actually know what that man thinks about it because he can't talk properly, he can't articulate himself. We don't know what the girl thinks about it. She may not even be in a mental state to even have an opinion on it. But these people are both healed because of the faith and requests of somebody else. Because somebody else has begged Jesus on their behalf. Now, we're not going to spend ages on this, but this should encourage us to cry out to God in prayer for other people. People who may not be able to do it themselves. People who may not be like wanting to do it themselves. That's what happens here. People come and they beg Jesus on behalf of somebody else and they're healed. Jesus doesn't turn people away because they're desperate. He doesn't say to this woman, "Oh, you're only coming to me as a last resort." Like she is desperate. She is coming to him, just falling at his feet, begging. And he has compassion and he heals. Even if you are coming as a last resort, even if you're only crying out to him because you're desperate, he has compassion. Now, this same story with Jesus and the woman is told in another one of the biographies called Matthew. And that's quite helpful because it gives a couple more details that fill in here. And that, the same story in Matthew tells us that this wasn't just like a one-off, like quick request from this woman. She'd persevered. It got to the point where the disciples had started to get frustrated because they say, oh, she kept crying out after them. She persevered. She was begging Jesus on behalf of somebody else, and Jesus had compassion and healed the daughter. I just wonder how many people in here would say, yeah, I feel like I'm begging God to intervene for somebody else, and it's a desperate situation. I don't know what else to do. I'm just crying out to God on that person's behalf. That person may also be crying out to God, or they may be not able to cry out to God, or they may be not wanting to cry out to God, but you're crying out to them. You're crying out to God for them. I'd say if that's you, like, don't lose heart. This shows, like, we don't always know when God's going to do something or how he's going to do it, but I would encourage you to keep going. On the other hand, how many of us in here can look back in our own lives and see the effect of somebody else praying on our behalf? There'll be loads of us here who say, actually, I'm only here this afternoon because somebody has prayed on my behalf. Somebody praying for us, persevering and praying, crying out to God for us long before we ever came to Jesus. One of the writers that I read on this talked about the demon-possessed daughter. And it's a bit cheesy. It's not the sort of phrase I would normally say, but it's powerful in its own way. So he's talking about the demon-possessed daughter. And he said, hopeless and desperate as her case appeared, she had a praying mother. And where there's a praying mother, there is always hope. They said, like, if there's somebody praying, like, no matter how hopeless the situation seems, if there's somebody over there, like you don't even know that they're there, but they're praying about this situation, then there's always hope. Keep praying for whoever it is. When there's someone praying, there's always hope. That's just the first sort of thing I wanted to mention. And the second one is really about the character and the response of this woman. It's her humility. The phrase that Jesus says to her here when she begs Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter is one of the strangest things that Jesus says to anybody, really. Where he says, first, let the children eat all they want. It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. He's saying, like, there's children, there's dogs. Seems to be saying that she's one of the dogs. Thankfully, the same story in Matthew 15 makes it a little bit clearer because he says a bit more. And he says, the first time she asks, he says, I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Seems to be that in this little children and dogs thing that Jesus is saying, the children are God's, like, God's people, Israel, and the dogs are the Gentiles. And first, let the children eat all they want, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Not right to take Israel's bread and toss it to the Gentiles. Now, this seems like a massive insult. I don't think it's as much of an insult as it maybe first seems to us. There's records of Jews calling Gentiles dogs as like a derogatory term. But the word that Jesus uses here, translated as dogs, is sort of a nicer version of that word. It's not referring to wild dogs. It's something that's translated as little dogs. And apparently, these sort of dogs were commonly had as pets. Still don't think it's great to call a woman a dog in general, in our context, no matter what sort of dog it is that you're talking about. But I don't think, when we read this, it's like, Jesus calling Gentiles dogs, and he's saying he's not doing anything. Well, that doesn't fit with what he's doing, does it? Because he's already interacted with and healed Gentiles. He's about to heal this woman. He's about to heal another Gentile man. In the next chapter, he's going to feed 4,000 Gentiles miraculously in the same way that he's fed thousands of Israelites miraculously. He's not against Gentiles. Like, you can't read the story of Jesus and say that he is. So his reply, I don't think that he says that he's against the Gentiles or even that he hasn't come for the Gentiles, but that his primary focus is on the Jews. First, let the children eat all they want. Jesus interacted with a notable number of Gentiles during his ministry, and that's because other Jewish leaders and teachers and rabbis wouldn't have interacted with any. But it is true to say that most of Jesus' ministry was to Jewish people. And it's not really until after his death that we see the church really start to spread into Gentile areas in the book of Acts that Ben read a bit from earlier on. I think this is a bit similar to the miracle where Jesus turns water into wine. And Jesus' mother, Mary, comes and sort of asks Jesus to do something because they've run out of wine. And he changes water into wine, but he says to her first, "My hour has not yet come." He uses it as a teaching moment to say he is going to do it, and he does do it. But he's making a point of, like, you know, there's something else going on here. It's a teaching moment for his disciples here when he says this. It's a teaching moment for everybody else that will ever read this story, including us today. He is going to heal this woman's daughter, but he wants to just use it as a teaching moment to say that's not the primary focus of where his mission is. He's just been, as I said earlier, in a disagreement with the Pharisees over ritual purity and religious traditions. And Jesus said it's not external things that make you clean or unclean. This is a demonstration of that. This is a Gentile, worse than a Gentile woman, in their opinion, from this notorious area of Tyre that's like pagan, worships other gods. Jesus not only interacts with her, but grants her request and heals her daughter. And so Jesus' words then about this children and dogs thing pose a question to his followers. Is it right to take food from the children of God and give it to the dogs? Should he be spending time on this woman where they might be thinking, oh, there's more worthy people he could be healing back at home? I don't think that Jesus is insulting the woman, but he is saying that healing her daughter is not the primary purpose of why he's come. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute, but just to see her response, the woman doesn't take it as an insult. Yeah, she says, "Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." She doesn't take it as an insult, but the more I've thought about this week, we would absolutely take it as an insult. Like, we live in a culture that looks to get insulted about anything. Like, we just want to get outraged. Find anything like, oh, I can't believe that. It's outrageous. We're so highly sensitive to any perceived disrespect. Like, the idea of Jesus saying no to a request, or even if he's not saying quite no, but saying wait, that idea, we would have been out of the door as soon as we heard the word dogs, like writing a strongly worded complaint on Jesus' online review platform or whatever it was. And because we'd be so fuming and out of there, we would have missed the miracle. Like, she got the miracle. No, her response is humble. She doesn't come to it thinking that she deserves anything from Jesus. She hears this, like, slightly strange statement about the children and the dogs, and she enters into it and she says, like, look, I'll take a crumb. And she gets the crumb, and the crumb from Jesus is like the best thing that's happened in her life. Just put yourself in that situation. She's got a daughter who's been possessed by an evil spirit, and now she's healed. The crumb that she got from Jesus is the best thing that's ever happened to her. One writer on this sort of trying to put ourselves in the woman's place is sort of saying this. It's as if she's saying, "Yes, Lord, I understand I have no prior claim to your mercy. I'm not numbered among the children. I can't jump up on the table and feast upon the food that you set before your children. All I'm asking is that you would just let one crumb that falls from your table come into my mouth and I'll be satisfied. Heal my daughter, please. I know she's not in your family. I know she's not numbered among the children. We're the dogs who wait for the crumbs, but one crumb is all I'm asking for." He says, this woman knows that she has no grounds to expect help, but she's talking to Christ, the Messiah. Now look, God owes me nothing. God's given me the gift of life and everything that I have and everything that I've experienced. And what do I do with that? I snatch it and try and run off in my own direction. So how can I dare to imagine that I'm just like sitting across the table from Jesus demanding something of him, or maybe just asking, but if he's going to say no, then I'm going to withdraw my allegiance. It's ridiculous. I'm not sitting at the table across from Jesus, his equal. I'm a dog under the table, hoping for a crumb. And if I'm humble enough to receive that crumb, it's going to be, like it was for this woman, the best thing that has ever happened to me. Now, Jesus is not in the habit of wanting us to think, oh, I'm just a worthless dog under the table. That's not what it is. But we do need to recognize that we're not on a par with him, that our sin has created a barrier, that anything we get from him is his grace and his mercy. And I don't want to let for us to let our pride be a barrier to receiving what Jesus has got for you. It's like, I'm not having a crumb. I want the bread off the table. Like, the pride's going to mean that you miss what Jesus has got for you. Everything Jesus gives us is a free gift. But if you've stormed off at the mere suggestion that you don't have a right to that, then you're going to miss the greatest gift that it's possible to receive. So let's just think then, who is Mark saying that Jesus is based on these stories, these two stories? Jesus is not just randomly going around doing things. He heals people, but these are signs to his primary mission, his real mission. They are not the mission itself. The healings here are really the amazing crumbs that's like dropping off the table of the real stuff that he's preparing on the table. And so Mark's inviting us to ask the question of who Jesus is. And we see a lot of people not really getting it. A lot of people today don't get who Jesus really is. A lot of people then didn't get who Jesus is. A couple of chapters ago, we had Jesus providing miraculous bread for 5,000 people. And in the next chapter, we're going to have Jesus providing miraculous bread for a different group of 4,000 people. You've got these two bread miracles either side. And after that miraculous feeding of bread, and Jesus had an interaction with his disciples where he said, look, you haven't understood about the loaves. You didn't get it. You were there, you saw what happened, but you didn't quite get it. You hadn't understood about the loaves. And sticking with that bread sort of idea, right in the middle is this, where a woman who just gets a few crumbs and understands way more about Jesus than the most knowledgeable about of all the Pharisees. So I think there's two things we need to say about who is Jesus here. And they won't be a surprise to you, but I just want us to really think about them and ponder them today. First one is that Jesus is gracious. Grace is the most controversial thing about Christianity, and it's the heart of Christianity. If we don't think it's controversial, then we haven't quite understood how unbelievable his grace is. This woman is from Syrian Phoenicia, and so she's become known, as everybody who's read, like people have read the Bible throughout the centuries, as the Syro-Phoenician woman. That's what it says in that little heading just before verse 24, the Syro-Phoenician woman. And Jesus shows grace to this Syro-Phoenician woman. Well, there is another Syro-Phoenician woman in the Bible, in the Old Testament. It's in 1 Kings 17, if you wanted to read it later. Just to summarize what's happening there, there's a big drought. God has spoken through his prophet Elijah to say it's not going to rain for 3.5 years. And so there's a drought and a famine. And Elijah goes to this area, like Tyre, and he meets a woman, a Syro-Phoenician woman. And he asks her to give him some water to drink and make a little loaf of bread for him. And she's like, oh, like, I don't know whether you realize there's a famine here. She said, I've basically got one small amount of flour, a little bit of oil, and what I was just about to do was to make a small loaf that me and my son were going to eat, and that's all we've got. We basically, this is our last meal, and we're heading towards death. And he says, right, okay, make me something first, and then God's going to provide. And so she does that. And miraculously, the jar of flour and the jug of oil never run out for the 3.5 years that the drought and the famine exists. Sometime later, her son dies and Elijah raises him back to life. And with Elijah's interactions with this Syro-Phoenician woman, she ends up saying, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. This was a woman who was outside the kingdom of God, who received his amazing grace. Now, Jesus refers to that when he's speaking to some Jewish people. So in Luke chapter 4, Jesus is in a synagogue, and he reads some words from the prophet Isaiah, and he says, today that's been fulfilled in your hearing. He's saying, like, that's all talking about me. And that's like a massive, like, crazy, like, inflammatory sentence that he says. But I'd remembered that incorrectly when I looked it back up. I thought that after he said that, the people grabbed him and went to throw him off a cliff. But it's not actually after he says that. He says something else. And what he says after that is, I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was severe famine. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow of Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And it's when he says that, that the people become furious. Before that, they were just amazed. When he says that, the Jewish people are furious and they grab hold of him and they take him and they try to throw him off a cliff. They're furious that God's plan even includes people other than them. They're furious at the idea that God shows grace to people who they think don't deserve it. And that's what this story confronts us with. The people who are fuming over ritual purity and who's in and who's out are so proud and self-centered that they miss God's grace. Whereas this new Syrophoenician woman approaches Jesus humbly. She knows she doesn't deserve anything from God, and she's in exactly the right place to receive the gift. It's like I said before, are you going to walk away fuming because you think you deserve the loaf? Or are you going to graciously receive the crumbs and have your life transformed? I think Jesus is gracious, and that's like, it's crazy, but it's so amazing. Secondly, Jesus has come to save. So in Isaiah chapter 35, it says this, strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. You know, for centuries, the Jewish people had hung on to these sort of words. When's God going to come? When is God going to come and save us? We'll know when he's come to do it, because then we're going to see blind eyes be opened and deaf ears be opened and lame people leaping like deers and mute tongues shouting for joy. Well, that's what's happening around Jesus. He's fulfilling these words. The deaf ears have been unstopped. The mute tongue shouts for joy. And so according to those words from Isaiah, that's the signs that you're supposed to look for. When you see that happening, you know that God has come. He's come to strengthen feeble hands. He's come to speak comforting words to those with fearful hearts. And he came to save. The eyes, ears, limbs, tongues, other things that Jesus healed weren't the salvation in themselves. They were the sign that he'd come to do the salvation. When Jesus is saying to the woman that healing her daughter isn't his primary mission, that isn't because his primary mission is to go and heal another daughter somewhere else. His primary mission was to conquer sin and heal the entire creation. His death on the cross absorbed the penalty for all sin. And that means it's possible for everyone in here to be saved. His resurrection that we were singing about earlier displayed a glorious victory over death that paves the way for us to live in eternity with him. And as I was reading that chapter of Isaiah, just that Jesus is fulfilling here, I just read to the end of the chapter, and there's a brilliant verse at the end of Isaiah chapter 35. That talks about that future that I've just mentioned. It says, everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Like, everlasting joy. Like, how much would you give for temporary joy, let alone everlasting joy? Well, you don't have to give everything, anything. You just have to receive. Like, just put yourself in the position of that woman or the Syrophoenician woman or the man and his friends, they would say, yeah, these verses describe us. Gladness and joy have overtaken us. Their sorrow and sighing has fleed away. That's our future. You accept Jesus' grace, if you accept his salvation, that's your future. If you feel as you're going on through life that sorrow and sighing are only ever increasing, then don't lose hope. Because Jesus has power over all of that. And as it says here, like you're running, your sorrow and sighing are weighing you down, but you're going to get overtaken with gladness and joy. I'm just going to pray for us, and just as we do, just reflect on that. We want to receive Jesus' grace, come before him humbly like this woman did, like falling at his feet. We're not coming to him like making a bargain or like making any demands. We're just coming to him empty-handed, knowing that he's merciful and gracious and receiving what he's got to give. That might be the first time you've ever wanted to do that this afternoon. And that, if that is you, then just pray that yourself. Just say to God that you're coming before him with empty hands. You just want to receive what he's got for you. And if that is you, just please do talk to one of us or talk to whoever invited you afterwards. And we'd love to help you think through that. But let's just pray together now.